thank you, President Huddleston, for hosting this important gathering here today. Today, for the first time ever, an administration is releasing guidance under Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, explaining how schools and colleges should deal with sexual violence. Sexual violence is one of those issues we all wish didn't exist, and too often our society has chosen to ignore it rather than confronting it openly and honestly, and that denial must end. Every school would like to believe it's immune from sexual violence, but the facts suggest otherwise. According to one widely referenced study, 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted while in college, and women are not the only victims. About 6% of male college students also report being sexually assaulted. And the problem is not limited to higher education. Recent data show that there were nearly 4,000 reports of sexual battery and over 800 reported rapes and attempted rapes in our nation's high schools. By some estimates, more than 1 in 10 high school girls is physically forced to have sex in or out of school. Moreover, these figures are probably low because we all know sexual assault is a notoriously underreported crime. It carries overtones of shame and insecurity. Victims are more likely to suffer academically and to suffer from depression, drug, and alcohol abuse. And tragically, some of them take their own lives. Police and prosecutors have the job of investigating sexual assaults and enforcing the laws, but educational institutions, including K-12 schools, colleges, and universities, also share responsibility under federal civil rights laws. Today's guidance, which is being sent to all school districts, colleges, and universities that receive federal funds, spells out those responsibilities. It also provides practical examples of how schools can meet those responsibilities. Our guidance discusses proactive efforts schools can take to prevent sexual violence. It provides examples of strategies that schools and our Office for Civil Rights are using to help end sexual violence and remedy its effects. Schools must make sure that victims know their rights and are kept informed during investigations, some of which can drag on for months or longer, creating undue stress for the victim. Schools must give victims the supports they need and protect them from a suspect who may be free on bail while charges are pending or still on campus during a Title IX investigation. The guidance recommends suggestions for outreach, campus climate, and training and technical assistance for school personnel. We explain the responsibility of schools and university faculty for assaults that occur off campus. We explain how schools can use disciplinary procedures to resolve complaints involving sexual violence. We explain legal issues around sexual violence and a school's civil rights responsibilities and how Title IX offers added protections to sexual violence victims. When incidents occur, our Office of Civil Rights, which is being led by Assistant Secretary Ruslan Ali, who's doing an extraordinary job, can help and can receive complaints in any of our 12 regional sites across the country. Our office can launch proactive investigations, and in fact, some are currently underway. Several others have been resolved, and they now have on-site monitoring to ensure that schools and colleges keep their commitments. As caring adults, as parents, and as leaders, we must deal with the brutal truth. And the facts around these incidents can be shocking. More and more incidents where young girls are subject to gang rape, schools where sexual assault victims are publicly humiliated and ostracized, colleges that have allowed the defendant to present witnesses, but not the victims. Routinely, we find that victims and their parents are not well informed, or cases that drag on so long that the alleged attackers withdraw from school before justice is ever served. We find cases where the victims are not taken seriously because they used alcohol or otherwise broke school rules leading up to or during the assault. We've even had cases where colleges impose gag orders on victims or threaten them with disciplinary charges if they told anyone about the outcome of an investigation. The misplaced sense of values and priorities in some of these cases is staggering. So there's a great deal of information spelled out in our guidance, and we have offices all across the country to help schools and universities address these issues. We have to do better, and we have to do better now. Our first goal is prevention. That's so critically important, prevention through education. Information is always the best way to combat sexual violence. We need to raise awareness about this issue because sexual violence has no place in society, and especially not in our nation's schools. Our larger goal is to help make sure our nation's schools and colleges are free of any form of physical threat or bullying. And we also have an Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools to support student safety programs. Between these two offices, we are deeply committed to the safety and security of every student in America, because we know that if children and young people aren't safe, they can't learn. It's as simple and as fundamental a priority as that. And we're very, very fortunate to have an extraordinary partner, friend, and leader in this effort, the Vice President of the United States. Vice President Biden has been active on this issue throughout his long and distinguished career in government. In the Senate, he authored the Violence Against Women Act in 1994, and in the White House, he has been a voice of reason, wisdom, and passion on these issues and on so many others. No one I know is more committed to protecting our children and young people and giving them every opportunity to thrive and to succeed in the classroom and in life. And I also know how lucky I am to work with and for the Vice President. He's been an extraordinary mentor and role model for me since I came to Washington. We're going to hear from the Vice President in a moment, but before we do, I want to introduce Sarah Jane Bebo, who is a student, an advocate, and a counselor, and a leader on this issue. She has made this issue her life's work, and it's an honor to have her join us today at this historic announcement. Please welcome Sarah Jane Bebo.
Today, speaking about an issue that means so much to me. It's no surprise that you chose UNH for your announcement, because we have a dedicated and determined student body and an amazing sexual assault prevention program that is so unique to a college campus. It's extremely difficult and risky for a victim of sexual assault to reach out and get help. But our SHARP program has a 24-hour crisis line and serves us right here on campus to support victims of sexual assault and provide them and their family and friends with resources to begin the healing process. I got involved with SHARP because I want to help victims rebuild their lives. I've learned that little things mean so much, like a friend saying, "I'm here for you, I believe you, I support you 110%. I'm amazed by how strong people are and how much they can overcome. I'm also amazed at all the ways our campus community can make a difference. Like the Know Your Power campaign that has simple steps that you can take to help to prevent a sexual assault. I've decided to dedicate my career to fighting for justice for victims, but I cannot do it alone. Ending rape will take all of us working together. We need to come together and support every single individual in order to put a stop to sexual violence. That's why it's so important to have three powerful individuals here on stage today saying there's never any excuse for rape. Vice President Biden has been advocating to end sexual violence for a long time. He's held up the most vulnerable in our society, and he has challenged the most powerful. By speaking to our community today, he's giving all of us, our generation, the chance to show the world what we can do. Please join me in welcoming our Vice President.
President, I'm accustomed to saying that every morning. It's good to see you, Mr. President. I won't expose you and tell you your University of Delaware connections, but thank you most of all for allowing a University of Delaware graduate to be on campus here. I appreciate it very much, and it's good to be back. Also, we have with us today, I'm told, New Hampshire State Representative Timothy Horgan. Representative Horgan, are you here? Good to see you, man. And also Jenna Roberts, State Rep. Jenna Roberts. Nice to see you, Jenna. And also I see a very good friend, one of my closest, two of my closest friends up here, former Chief Justice Broderick, now Dean Broderick, and the guy sitting next to him is a federal judge who I had the honor of suggesting should make would make a good judge, and he sure has done that. Mr. Judge, how you doing, man? Good to see you. Folks, it's good to be back here. There's a great deal of talk, a great deal of subject matter we can talk about today in any college campus, from the economy to foreign policy to the unrest in North Africa to the from North Africa to the subcontinent of India. There's a great deal on America's plate today. And any one of the subjects or subsets of subjects I just raised would be worthy of discussion on a great university's campus. But I want to talk to you about something I believe very, very strongly in, and I'm absolutely convinced we can make a difference in. And that is how to improve the measure of our decency as a society. How America is viewed and how we view ourselves. I'm not talking about those divisive social issues that divide us based on ideology. I'm talking about what we state to be a collective national value, and that is to fight the abuse of power, no matter where it comes from. Fight the abuse of power that forces individuals to submit to our will merely because we individually or institutionally are more powerful. We as Americans have said from the outset, that's wrong. It's simply wrong. We've said indirectly to the rest of the world, measure us by how well we abide by that stated value. For I believe that is the measure of the decency of a nation. The decency of a nation is more determined by how we tolerate or do not tolerate the abuse of women, the abuse of anyone who finds themselves in a situation where someone physically is more powerful than they, imposing their will on them merely because they're more powerful. Lest you think this is just a Biden judgment, because I've been so passionate about this for so many years, think about how we judge other nations, how we measure other nations. We do it all the time. Nations and cultures allow fathers to auction off their daughters' virginity, as some do, the stoning of women, honor killing, forced genital mutilation. Each of those nations and those cultures that permit such activities, such behavior, are viewed by the vast majority of Americans as less civilized, and in some cases, barbaric, because those practices do exist, or either condoned or tolerated in other parts of the world. But we say as Americans that respect and dignity for all, freedom from physical and sexual abuse, we say, that's who we are and that's what we're about. In truth, it's the ultimate definition of what constitutes, in my view, a civilized society. And that's what I want to talk about today. How are we measuring up to our own stated standard of decency? I'm here to talk with you about physical abuse and sexual assault, and specifically on college campuses, and what we can and must do about it. You just heard from Secretary Duncan, who is literally the star of the cabinet. This guy is totally, thoroughly, I mean it sincerely, I've said it from the outset. You've heard me say it, John. This guy is thoroughly, thoroughly authentic. Everything he does and says is who he is. And he laid out for you, at least in more definition than I'm going to now, because I want to speak about something even broader, the announcement that we're making today, and we've made today, and he made today. You know, we've come a long way. We've made a lot of progress in the last 20 years since the Violence Against Women Act was enacted. It's the first time, as a nation, we publicly acknowledge, at least at a federal level, that there was this dirty little secret that existed even in American society. The domestic abuse of women. There is no prison as horrible. There is no prison as demeaning. There is no prison as unacceptable as the prison that so many women in this country are held within the four walls of their own home. My dad used to say, it is the cardinal sin of all sins to abuse, physically abuse, someone who trusts you, someone you know, someone who says they love you. And over 1,000 hours of hearings in the Violence Against Women Act, we also learned the catastrophic consequence it has for the women who were abused and the families of those who witnessed the abuse. Abuse is a learned behavior. If you want to do one thing to end violence in America, or to impact on it the most, end abuse against women in our society. The studies show the only thing that people have in common who are held behind bars in jail for violent crimes is they can't read and they witness their mother or somebody in their family being abused repeatedly. It's a learned behavior. It's totally counterintuitive, but it's a learned behavior. But what it's all about is an individual's responsibility not only to not engage in such behavior, but I want to talk to a little bit what you mentioned about the requirement, the moral obligation, the citizenship required to expose it when you see it and when you know it's occurring. Abusing your wife or significant other is not a family matter. That's the first hurdle we had overcome back in the 80s when I started this. So many groups, some even religious groups, said this is a private matter. It's a family matter. I wish we stopped using the word domestic abuse. It sounds like a domesticated cat. It is the worst of all abuse, leaving the deepest and most searing scars. It is not a family matter. It is a crime. It's an abhorrent act. And the solution begins when we as a society acknowledge that and begin to change our own personal behavior. In 1984, I was working on the issue as the ranking member of the Criminal Law Subcommittee, to sound like a wonk. And I thought I had been holding hearings on violence in America because there was a spike in violence in America, traced in large part to the increased use of cocaine and crack cocaine. And I remember receiving a study from the material from the Bureau of Justice Statistics that follows all violent crime in America. And I learned that while violent crime against men ages 18 to 30, which everyone assumed was skyrocketing, it actually went down during this period. The violent crime against women 18 to 30 was skyrocketing. I was startled by those statistics, those facts, and I began to delve into the subject, and I discovered that there was this dirty little secret in our society. That domestic abuse was fairly widespread and vastly, vastly underreported. There are a number of reasons. One was the unequal application of the law. My own beloved state of Delaware, there was a law in the books that said you could not be convicted of first-degree rape if the woman knew you and had gone out with you before. If I leaped out an alley behind a garbage can and someone violently raped a woman, that's first-degree rape. If the rape was equally as violent, but you had gone out with the man before, it could not be first-degree rape. And there are many other states with similar similar applications, or lack of application of law. It was also considered a family matter. Literally, some of the toughest mail I got as the author of this initiative was from people telling me this is a private matter, how I discipline my wife. Taking you back to the 14th century in Great Britain, you all know the origin of the phrase rule of thumb. So many women were being beaten to death in common law courts of Great Britain because they were considered chattels under English common law. They came up with the common law rule that you could not punish your wife with a rod that was thicker than the circumference of your thumb. There's another reason why it wasn't being reported. The overwhelming stigma of reporting such a crime. Women were not only embarrassed, fearful, but they often got blamed. And they often got figuratively she'd be raped in the criminal system once it went on trial. Figuratively speaking. There was also the issue, which is time-honored and continues, in a nation which rightly says you're not guilty until you're proven, and you're not guilty until proven guilty, beyond a reasonable doubt. It is that one crime that seldom has witnesses. And it's he said, she said. These were all brought home to me, these impediments, and focused when I was given a study that was published in Rhode Island in 1988, a respected study. It was a study of junior high school students throughout the state of Rhode Island. And an astounding, there were many, many eye-opening things in the study, but one of the questions that stuck in my mind asked of the students was, if a man spent money on a date with a woman, was he entitled to force sex on that woman? An astounding 25% of the young boys said yes. But even more astounding, was 17% of the junior high school girls agreed with the statement. That's when I decided we had to not only make the law more fair and apply it, but we had to try to begin to change attitudes about sexual abuse. And that's when I sat down without a lot of support initially, and wrote the Violence Against Women Act. On June 20th, 1980, I held the first hearing as chairman of the Committee on the Violence Against Women Act. And a young woman, not unlike you, a bright student, an attractive personality, agreed to come and testify. Her name was Christine. Here's what she said. She said that she attended a small Catholic college named St. Francis College outside of Pittsburgh. It was her freshman year. It was during student orientation. She went, as I recall it, to a bonfire celebrating the first and a fraternity party that the first game was going to be played. They don't have a football team, so I think it was a soccer game. That year, school had actually not officially begun class. And she was walking back from this event with her girlfriend's boyfriend, and it was chilly. And he asked whether or not he could stop in his dorm, and she said, "Grandma, he got a coat." She said, "Of course." She walked in with him. He pulled in the room, closed the door, and forcibly raped her. Afterwards, the most chilling part of this to me was reinforcing what the studies had said. She said she went back to her room, another dormitory, and she said, I remember, she was on the garret floor, the fourth floor, the third floor, the top floor. She got undressed and she said, I went and I took a scalding shower. I remember her saying, a scalding shower. She said she wrapped a towel around her bathrobe, I don't recall which, and went back to her room and was sitting on the end of her bed, telling some of her floor mates what had happened. And the RA came in and asked what happened and sat in the bed with her. And the RA said, you've been raped. And she said, under oath, looking at me, I looked at the RA and said, no, I wasn't. I knew him. No, I wasn't. I knew him. This was an intelligent. She went on to switch universities, graduated with a degree, was a first-rate intelligent student from a middle-class family. Later that year, we had another young witness. We had many. But to make another point that we didn't want to acknowledge in those studies in college, we had another young woman who came and testified, older, that exposed another unspoken cultural norm about who's responsible when such things happen. Her name, you may remember, was Marla Hanson, Henson, H-E-N-S-O-N. It took a lot of courage to come and testify. She was a model in New York City. She lived in an apartment complex. And the owner of the complex kept importuning her to go out with him, and she kept refusing. And I guess it basically amounted to harassment, how often he kept asking her out. And so, at work, a modeling job, she got a call from her landlord, it was in New York City, a large high-rise apartment building, and said, I'd like to meet you in the bar that was in the basement of the building, in the ground floor of the building, you know, to discuss your rent with you. So she left work and showed up. He was there. He asked her out again. She would not go. And when she was leaving, he walked outside, and two or three, I'm not sure the number, I don't remember the number, thugs grabbed her and slashed her face with a razor. Not go out with the landlord. She wasn't going to be, quote, attractive enough to go out with anyone. He was convicted. But I had spoken to her earlier and I knew what she was going to testify to. I said, what was the response you got when you reported this? Not from the police or bystanders, but from friends and family. She put her head down and she said, they asked me, why was I in a bar? Why did I go to that bar? I should have known better. It's absolutely clear to me that it was time once and for all for our society to rid itself even of the subconscious notion that there's a distinction between being abused at the hand of someone you know and a total stranger. As I said earlier, as a matter of fact, there is more damage done psychologically at the hand of someone you know. You always question, what did I do? Why did I not know? The second societal myth that I'm absolutely convinced needed to and needs to be eliminated is that there is ever a justification for a man to raise a hand to a woman for any reason other than self-defense. And that no circumstance, none holds the abuser harmless. Because the victim's judgment was either impaired or she made a judgmental mistake. When it comes to sexual abuse, it's quite simple. No means no. No means no if you're drunk or you're sober. No means no if you're in bed, in a dorm, or on the street. No means no, even if you said yes at first and you changed your mind. No means no. And it's a crime to disregard no. The allocation of blame has been, for too many centuries, allocated in a way that's totally irrelevant and inappropriate. You know, it's almost as if when it comes to domestic abuse, we're applying the negligence theory of the law. It's a little like saying, you know, you left your home, the door, front door open when you went to the store, the lights were on, so you invited the home invasion. When a group of thugs entered your home, stole everything, and when you drove up the driveway, abused you. Lest you think I'm exaggerating, you heard some of the examples that the Secretary used. Remember one of the early examples, and my two colleagues on the bench will remember this. There was a Florida judge, when I was writing this law, who dismissed a rape case against a man because the woman who was raped was sitting in a bar with, on a bar stool with an exceedingly revealing skirt on. Fortunately, he was ripped off the bench. And we changed the law, I'm proud to have written, saying under no circumstance during a trial can what a woman was wearing or what her sexual proclivities or behavior was before with other people, it is not admissible. But that did not even get an overwhelming majority of votes in the United States Senate initially. So those of you who think we don't need to change our attitude, there's still more to do. We've made a great deal of progress since passage of the Violence Against Women Act. We've reduced the incidence of domestic violence by more than 50%. We've created partnerships that didn't exist before, as the local police can tell you, between state, local, and federal law enforcement agencies and local authorities. We've set up a domestic hotline, a hotline that today continues to answer more than 22,400 calls per month. And imagine the courage it takes for a woman to pick up the phone and call and say, I don't know who's in the other end, but I need help. We didn't have the technology to handle all the calls. I contacted the leaders of the major technology firms from Microsoft to Oracle to Dell, and they all agreed to come down and help and make a back office that would be equivalent to a bank not losing a customer. But I asked them to do one thing. I asked them when they had all these CEOs down there, I didn't want them to send their individual, their underlings down, or their technicians, wanted them to go, and they did. And I asked the hotline director to literally pipe in to this room, which is about half, a third of the size of this room, where all the people are sitting in cubicles taking these calls, to pipe in a loudspeaker one of the calls. One of the calls was, I'm in a mall in Minneapolis, and I'm standing between Kids Gap and Ridge. Oh my God, I see him, oh my God, he's coming, please help me, please help me. At transfigured and transformed all of those men and one woman who stood in that room and heard it. It takes an immense amount of courage. So when we wrote the act, we made sure that there are decent shelters and provided, over time, $several billion. The reason why children are homeless in the street, 70% are there because their mothers are victims of abuse. The reason why women don't leave sometimes, there's no place to go. They have no wherewithal to leave and take care of their children. So we have women's shelters all across America. We have stay-away orders that are now enforced when they weren't before. We have police training. We have sharing of court records now so that when you show up in one court with a stay-away order, another court knows you, that court can find out it was issued because of the technology available to us today. And so much more. But also so much more needs to be done to empower younger women, as well as empower and educate younger men. I told you about that Rhode Island study. A new study, quote unquote, 2009. There was a new study in 2009, similar, of sixth grade students. We found that 1 in 4 thought it was acceptable for boys to hit their girlfriends. I understand this is a difficult period in everyone's development, preteens, adolescents, and teens. But the clearer the rules, the clearer it is that society will not countenance such behavior, the more likely will empower young girls and teach young men that it's never, ever, ever, ever permissible to touch a woman without her consent. Look, guys, all you guys in the audience, no matter what a girl does, no matter how she's dressed, no matter how much she's had to drink, it's never, 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 never okay to touch her without her consent. This doesn't make you a man. It makes you a coward. A flat-out coward. Stories like Christine, the first young woman who testified, are going on still today in college campuses around the country. That's why we're here, introducing this new regulation. And what we need is we need your help to stop it from happening. It is within our control. And we're here today not only to point out such acts as a crime, but also to, again, with the news media communicating it for us, hopefully, that there's an affirmative responsibility of citizenship. There's an affirmative responsibility of colleges, universities, community colleges, to be proactive in protecting what amounts to the civil rights of women on their campuses. Some of you probably heard the statistics. Women your age, those of you who are students here, experience the highest rates of violence from intimate partners. You heard how high the rate of sexual assault is on campus. 85% of the perpetrators of that assault against college women are someone the victim knew. The sad fact is, I know some of you in this room, some of you women and a few of you men, you've been sexually assaulted, women and men, but overwhelmingly women. And you've been living with that pain and trapped in that darkness because that's what it is. Let me tell you another story, a more recent one. A wonderful young woman, let's call her Jenny, was only 1 week into her freshman year last year, a time, by the way, incidentally, where women are especially vulnerable. Young women. And she was sexually assaulted by a fellow student living in her dorm. Like so many women, Jenny thought it would be best to seek justice through the university judicial board instead of going to the police and having a public trial. But the student disciplinary board asked Jenny an awful lot of offensive and irrelevant questions. They asked her what she was wearing, how she was dancing at the party, and had she been drinking. And in the end, the The student judicial panel said that they didn't find Jenny credible because she had been drinking. They decided her rapist was a nice kid and didn't deserve the punishment under the circumstances. Look, folks, rape is rape is rape. And the sooner universities make that clear, the sooner we'll begin to make progress on campuses. It's not sufficient to have criminal enforcement. We must, at every single level of our society, make clear the moral disapprobation of society at every level for such behavior. And by the way, conventional norms change. We have made progress even in conventional norms. 50 years ago, it would not be unusual to see a man grab his wife by the hand and pull her in public at a picnic, at a barbecue, at a restaurant. You don't see that very often today. It doesn't mean it doesn't occur, but it means the moral disapprobation of society has labeled those who engage in it pariah. Look, folks, the fact of the matter is colleges, universities, community colleges have to be part of the solution. They're in the best position to mitigate it. Students across the country deserve the safest possible environment in which to learn. That's why this new Title IX guidance Secretary Dunson talked about is such a significant deal. We're the first administration to make it clear that sexual assault is not just a crime, but it's a violation, it can be a violation of a woman's civil rights. We're saying that under Title IX, schools have a responsibility to bring justice to victims and change the culture on campuses that make it clear that sexual assault is simply not tolerable. Guys, in the end, in the very end, it's up to you guys. You have the most power to make the most difference. That's why I'm honored to be here on the University of New Hampshire's campus. That's why we picked the campus. You guys are doing it right. You're the model for the country. The Know Your Power campaign and the Bringing In the Bystander Project, your sexual harassment and rape prevention program, SHARP, all of this is making sure that everyone on this campus and this community is a part of the solution. They're telling you how you can safely intervene. They're raising awareness through technology so that everyone knows they can do something to change things. I wish all colleges had a little more UNH Wildcat in them. But even if all of you guys and your school, notwithstanding all you've done to reduce violence on campus, prevention is still more than anything else up to you. Look, these are your friends, these are your classmates, the people you study with, the people you have a beer with. You need to watch out for each other. You're the first and best line of defense. If you know something, speak up, say something. Call for help if you need it. We don't just need the victim to speak up after. Then it's too late. We need them to speak up as it's happening or before it happens. Let me say something as clearly as I can to the college, male college students out there. You guys have an absolute obligation as men to speak up. You want to measure your manhood. Measure it based on the gumption you have to speak up. If you see a man in any way threatening a woman on this campus, if a friend even hints at potential abuse, you have an obligation to speak up. You guys listen to each other more than you listen to anyone else. You guys talk to each other more than you do anyone else. Peer to peer, friend to friend. We know what works best, and that's how real change happens, peer to peer. The more and more you bring attention to the issue, the less and less the behavior goes unnoticed, unreported, and unpunished. And more attitudes begin to change, because really, changing attitudes is what we need to do most. Folks, if we're going to end violence, not reduce it, end it, we're going to have to change attitudes. That's the core of the problem. That's where you have to aim. And you are all in a position to help us do that. For all our progress, there's still a great deal more to do. As many as 1.1 million, 1 million women are victims of rape. 1.1 million. And a significant number are never reported. To put that in perspective, the entire state of New Hampshire is 1.3 million people. 15.5 million children are exposed to abuse every year and go on to be those who abuse. One in four women in the United States will be a victim of domestic abuse in their lifetimes. That is unless we do something to change it. I've given you some statistics. With each of those numbers, it's a single person. Somebody like you. Somebody you know. Somebody who needs help. There are people in this room who need your help. There are people on this campus and around the country who need your help. And you have the power to help them. So use it. There's no blanket solution. This is one woman at a time. One woman at a time. All of us have our work cut out for us. But trust me, attitudes can change. Look at how attitudes have changed in this country on so many other issues. Violence against women can end, but it can't happen without all of you speaking up and acting. Making known sexual assault, violence against women will not be tolerated anywhere, anytime, for any reason, period. There's a quote from a late rabbi, Menachem Sherenson. It goes like this. It says, every living thing, and especially a living person, must not remain static, but he is expected to grow from strength to strength. He must always add, even if he has already achieved good things and holy things. He should never be satisfied with what was achieved yesterday, no matter how perfect or good it was. No matter what we have done thus far in this subject, we need to do more. No matter how strong we are now, we need to pass that strength on to others. We must never be satisfied with what we achieved yesterday and keep working toward a better tomorrow for our mothers, our daughters, our sisters, and all those men who find themselves in abusive situations. So I'm asking you guys, I'm not going to ask you to stand, but I'm asking you privately, take a pledge to yourself. Promise yourself you will speak out. You will speak up. And by the way, it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to defy convention. But promise yourself. So stand up. As I said, this could be your sister, your aunt, your mother, a dear friend. You guys have it in your power to have the most impact. And women in the audience, no matter what your age, never, never, never accept the proposition. No matter what you did that wasn't physically violent yourself, that it was your fault if you were abused, your fault if you were raped, your fault if you were beaten. I'm optimistic. I'm one of those guys who believe, all those people believe, we can change. Individuals make a difference, like your fellow student sitting behind me. I don't know how many women, she doesn't know how many women she's already affected. But I promise you, when you're alone, when you feel caged, when you're victimized, the single most significant thing that can empower you is to know someone's listening. Somebody knows you're not alone. recognized for my passion on this subject, but I was raised by a man who was the most decent person I ever knew. People ask me why I feel so strongly about this. Was my mother, my sister, my daughters, were they? Thank God, to the best of my knowledge, none was ever abused. But my father was insistent that the cardinal sin of all was a man to raise his hand to a woman or a child. It's contrary to everything we say we are as Americans. So I'll end where I began. The measure of our civility is how we treat those who are most vulnerable. And we have an obligation not only to lead by the example of our power, but the power of our example. Thank you all very much.